your garden have the summer doldrums? Today on Garden Talk, we'll have some tips on how to bring your garden back. Hi, Jill Nadeau here. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Nationally known gardening expert Melinda Myers is back with us. She's a TV and radio host, author and columnist with over 30 years of horticulture experience, and she's written over 20 gardening books. What questions do you have for Melinda about keeping your garden healthy? What gardening problems are you having? Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
I'm really well. How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks.
Wonderful.
The weather has been great for weeds, a little challenging for gardeners and their plants, but hey, it's another exciting year in Wisconsin.
That's right, that's right. You know, Melinda, I've never got a chance to actually talk to you on the air. I've chatted with you beforehand, but, you know, I've always wondered, how did you actually get into this business?
You know, it's really kind of funny. My father was a gardener, but never let my brother and I in the garden. And
really?
Yeah, that's the secret, right?
Yeah, I guess.
And until he went overseas to help in Bangladesh, help people make pumps, water pumps. And so he left these almost like a book of directions to my mom and I, so when he'd get home in the middle of summer, his garden would be ready. So I always laugh. I wish I would have saved those notes.
Yeah.
And I always grew houseplants. You know, I was, you know, in the early 70s, late 60s, houseplants were kind of the hip and trendy thing, and they're coming back. And
they are.
And I love science, and I love people, and horticulture just seemed to be the way that I could do applied science, you know, digging, planting, you know, my lab is outdoors and big and not real sanitary. and I can talk to gardeners who are some of the best people in the world.
Yes, they sure are. They sure are. And then how did you get into the radio, TV, writing books part of it?
You know, I always wanted to be an extension agent. And when I was in college back then, they said, oh, you're from the city, you'll never be an extension agent. Well, lo and behold, I ended up in Milwaukee County and on some grants, and I became an extension agent. And that means you do radio and TV and write garden columns. And it was really very satisfying, a way to teach. And, and that's the way I look at all of it. For me, I'm really a teacher at heart, and so my classroom is radio, television, books, magazine articles, and then when I go and give lectures, which is so much fun because I get, and you know that, when you get to meet the people talk to, it's always a good time. Yeah. So I've been very lucky in my career.
Well, we're very lucky to have you with us, as always, and we want to talk a little bit about, you know, the gardens are looking a little sad this time of year. Is heat really the main culprit, or are there other problems that we have to worry about?
Well, a couple things that I'm seeing out in the gardens, all that rain early in the season, there are some plants that have suffered some root rot or stem rot or a few, you know, there are a few diseases going around. And then you throw the heat on top of it, which adds to the stress. We have this beautiful stand of Solomon seal at the gardens that we do at Wisconsin State Fair and Energy Park. And I'm like, wow, these stems are dying back, and I could easily pull them. And the plants are doing okay, but we've lost a few stems to some rot, and I lost some of my columbine also, not totally, but a little bit of dieback. And then the heat adds to the stress. And I think one of the things we always want to do is water, sometimes too soon. You know, we see plants wilting, right? Two in the afternoon, they're wilting. We get out the hose and we water. Sometimes we need to wait until evening to see if they perk up and then give them a good soaking if the soil is dry or just slightly moist. And then the other thing is thorough and less frequent, and mulch. I'll tell you, if you've mulched your garden, you can see the difference in the moisture retention and the health of your plants.
Do you have a special mulch that you like to use, or is mulch mulch?
Mulch. You know what? I love to use what's available.
Okay.
So my garden, leaves, you know, I gather leaves and shred them. A mower works great. And bag them up and save them for the garden. And then that's a wonderful mulch. It breaks down quickly, but it lasts a year or two, depending on how thick you put it. But it improves the soil. A friend of mine's neighbor was cleaning out under their evergreens and wanted to get rid of all those needles. And I'm like, really? I'll take them. So I feel this is when my daughter lived with me when she was younger. She was like, could you do these things in the dark, Mom? Too embarrassing. And so I have needles. I have needles and some small evergreen cones mulching my orchard. It looks beautiful. And it was free, and it repurposed that, so it didn't end up in the garbage or the landfill.
Well, that's a win-win situation all the way around.
You bet.
And we have got our lines are full, which I assume they would be, so let's get there right now. Our first caller is Helen in West Salem. Hi, Helen.
Hello. I have some questions about trimming branches off trees this time of year.
Is okay.
Is it okay to do that or not?
What kind of trees are they?
Well, I have a full-grown armor maple.
Okay.
And then I have a fairly new sunset maple, and then I have a flowering crab there.
Okay.
Three things that I would like to trim, if it's okay.
Yeah. This is an okay time with the crab apple, and we're seeing, crab apples are some are susceptible to fire blight, which is a bacterial disease. So avoid wet periods, which hasn't been a problem lately. But if you're pruning it, that disease can move in through wounds. So you want to try to watch the weather and wait for drier conditions. That's why late winter, early spring, when there's fewer insect and disease problems, is also a really good time to prune. With crab apples, if you over prune, you'll get lots more suckers, water sprouts, those stems that grow straight up. So if you have a lot of them now, take about a fourth to a third out, and then next year take more, and then next year take some more. If you take them all out at once, you'll end up with more than you started with. With your amur maple and sunset maple, it's fine to prune this time of year. No need for pruning paints on any of those. They've really found that traps moisture in rather than protecting the trees. And then pruning correctly. So if you're taking big branches back to the trunk, prune back to the branch bark collar. That's that swollen area, almost like a donut at the base of the branch. Flush with that. So you leave that because that's the tissue that's going to callus over your wound. But yeah, you can do some pruning this time of year. Just keep the plant healthy like you would normally in terms of proper watering. Mulch if you haven't. Don't pile mulch around the trunk and you'll be good.
Okay. Well, thanks for that question, Helen. That was one I think a lot of people want to know about. Let's go next to Mary in Dunnville. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have mulched our green peppers, and they're underproductive. They were yellow at the beginning of the year, and now they are not doing anything. We've mulched with leaves and straw in this hot weather, but kept the water constant, but they're sitting there.
Mary, I thank you for that question because I know a lot of people, their tomatoes and peppers may not be performing. When temperatures get in the 90s, like we've been having especially hot nights, peppers and tomatoes tend not to accept the pollen so that they can get pollinated and fertilized and form fruit. So with tomatoes, you could use like a blossom set, and they will actually form some smaller and some tomatoes. But with peppers, they tend to drop their blossoms, or in your case, haven't formed them yet. And so it sounds like you're doing everything right. I'm assuming you fertilized at the beginning of the season?
Yes.
Okay. And I would wait until you start getting fruit, unless you use a low-nitrogen, slow-release fertilizer. You don't want to interfere when the weather does cooperate. So really, you've done everything right. And now it's the hardest thing for gardeners, myself included, is patience.
Yeah,
wait for the right temperatures, and you should start seeing flowers and fruit. One of the things, too, I often see with peppers especially is we have plenty of phosphorus in our soil, but the plants can't pull it up because of our high pH in so much of the state and even the lower pHs. Milorganite did some research, and they found that when the microorganisms break down that fertilizer, it also releases some of the phosphorus bound to the soil and makes it available to the plant, as well as potassium. And so a lot of gardeners, myself included, have found some great benefit from using Milorganite or organic fertilizers as well to get that phosphorus that those plants need to flower and fruit. But in this case, I think it's just the heat that's really taking its toll.
Okay, thanks for the question, Mary, and good luck with those peppers. Next up is Rose in Menominee Falls. Hi, Rose. What question do you have for us?
Hi there. I'm so glad to get on. My Rose of Sharon and my hydrangea plants, when they came up in the spring, they at least came up. I had neighbors who lost their Rose of Sharon especially, and I have a beautiful one. But several of the branches coming out of the Rose of Sharon and the hydrangeas were dead. Now the hydrangeas, the rest of the foliage has filled in around it, and the Rose of Sharon has a fair amount of foliage on several of the branches. So do I cut out those dead branches? Do I do it now? Do I do it later? Do I leave them? What do I do?
Good question, Rose. And unfortunately, you're not alone, or fortunately. I don't know how you want to look at it. This was a year, I'll tell you things, I left a lot of dead-like plants standing, and it took until the middle or the end of June to start seeing growth. And so pruning out the dead wood now is a good idea because it's easy to decide what's dead and what's alive. Plus, it'll make it look better for you to enjoy the rest of the season. So cut it either back to ground level, if it's a sucker that came out of the, you know, shoot that came out of the ground, or back to good, healthy tissue. And when we make our cuts, we want to make them above a healthy outward-facing bud or above a outward-facing branch or back to the main stem, or if it's a shoot coming out of the ground, back to the ground. But, Rose, thank you for asking, because so many people, I see it in gardens all over the area. It's just the cold, open start to our winter was really hard. And you're right, Rose of Sharon's, a lot of the roses took a beating. So fortunately, many came back, but with some dieback like you experienced.
Okay, thanks for the question, Rose. And we'll go to Tammy in Greendale. Tammy, what can we help you with?
Hi, Melinda. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I put in a blackberry bush last year, and thank God it took the horrible winter, and it's doing very well. And I have a lot of blossoms. But now as the blossoms are turning into fruit, I can see the fruit beginning to form, but it's not maturing and it's not growing into a berry. Am I just being not patient enough, or what do you think I could be doing wrong? I'm a master gardener from a previous master gardener from Dodge and Jefferson Counties. I've looked into my publications that I received during those classes, and I have found everything but blackberry information. And this was just really timely that I was coming home and heard you on, and I'm going, oh, I got to give a call before I went in and started doing a whole mess of research.
Yeah. There's a little bit on raspberries and blackberries at the UW Extension, but blackberries aren't the most common crop, though the cool thing is there's some new thornless compact varieties out. One, I think, being patient, are the leaves and the stem looking fine?
I'm thrilled and so pleased with the winter and summer that we've had so far that it's doing so well. Growing very, very well. The green on the leaves are fabulous, and I have no disease. Because I am in the area of Greendale that unfortunately has a lot of deer, I've kept a row cover around it. I've surrounded it so they can't get at it, and I had a lot of bunnies. So I didn't want them to gorge and have me lose out. So
I hear.
I'm wondering, is it the row cover that I have? It's the thin material, white material, kind of gauzy type that I have around it. You know, I've tried everything. I'm not quite sure it's stumping me.
Yeah, I hear you. But the row cover's just around, not over the whole plant, correct?
It's not covering the plant. I know it needs a pollinator, so I don't have it covered. And, in fact, this afternoon, even in the heat, I'm going to go and expand the area around it. It's not crowded, but I'm thinking I probably should just, for giggles, give it some more room.
Yeah, I think be patient and wait, but it might also be heat. Heat, when you look at a lot of the research and resources online for a variety of fruits and vegetables, temperature stress, whether it's too cold or too hot, often interferes with either pollination and fertilization so we can get the fruit started, or the development and maturing of the fruit. And so these hot temperatures might be what's giving that problem. I think allowing more air circulation is not a bad idea. Usually in our summers, row covers are not an issue, but like you, I'm concerned about that heat buildup. Just a little bit more of heat is we don't need. It's so hot out there right now. Keep watering as needed. You're a master gardener, so you know how to do that, and the plants are healthy, so you've obviously been giving them proper care. And then I would just wait and see. Also, these are your first year, and sometimes that first year plants are putting a lot of energy, hopefully, into their roots. So that may also impact some of that fruit formation, often not a big crop. But I would give it some time because that's all you really can do. I don't think you're doing anything wrong. If it was a disease, you typically see some spotting, like anthracnose on berries. Often you see some spotting. The berries can be crumbly, but it sounds like yours aren't even forming. So that's why I think it's more temperature stress than anything.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question, Tammy. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network, and we're talking with Melinda Myers. She's a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, and author and columnist. And we're talking about taking your gardening questions. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, let's go right back to the phones because they're all full. And up next, we have Bill in Madison. Bill, what's your question?
Hey, thanks. A friend of mine was over at the garden the other day, and he was talking about using Epsom salts. And I kind of thought, well, I don't know about that. So I haven't done it, and I'm kind of don't think it's a great idea. But what do you think?
You know, this has been going around for many, many years. Rose growers are often, you know, the first one to say Epsom salts makes my garden look better. We typically don't need the nutrients that Epsom salts provides. Plus, when you start doing a lot of those under-the-counter remedies, you're yeah. often really spending more money to get the same results as if you buy a fertilizer. Plus, the fertilizer has been tested and checked. One of the things I love to recommend is Jeff Gilman, G-I-L-L-M-A-N, wrote several books, and it's The Truth and Myths About Garden Remedies, The Truths and Myths About Organic Gardening, and Decoding Garden Remedies, I think, is the other one. But what I like is he takes a lot of these, and he says, okay, here's what people are saying, here's the science behind it, here's the research, and he did some mini research projects, and he talks about, yep, this one really works, nope, this one isn't, or yeah, it works, but here's some concerns. And so what I really like, if you're someone like me that likes to, you know, check the sources and get to the bottom and understand, then you might want to check that out as well. But you're right. Epsom salts, we really don't need to add that to our soil.
Thanks for asking about that, Bill. Melinda, what was the name of the author on that again?
Dr. Jeff Gilman, G-I-L-L-M-A-N, formerly with the University of Minnesota. He's now at the University of North Carolina Charlotte Botanical Gardens.
Oh.
But if you ever see him on a program, he's a fun speaker to listen to. But good information, easy to read. I think people would enjoy it.
Okay, well, maybe I'll try to see if he can be a guest on Garden Talk. So I might have to look him up. Okay, thank you very much for that question. Let's go on to Sam in Madison. Sam, what's your question?
Hi. I just wanted to plug Chip Drop. It's a website called getchipdrop.com. It hooks you up with local tree services to get wood chips for free.
Oh.
Sam, thank you so much. And I forgot to mention that. When I worked for the city of Milwaukee, we were always trying to encourage people to help us reuse those wood chips. And tree services, and that is another resource. If there's a tree service in your area, what a great way to connect the two. You know, they're looking for a way to repurpose it in a landscape. It's a great mulch as paths around trees and shrubs. If you use it in your perennial garden, If it stays on the surface, fine. In annual gardens, I'd rake it off before you till, or just watch your nitrogen because the microorganisms break it down slowly and use some of the nutrients temporarily from your soil. But it's a great mulch and a great way to repurpose. So, Sam, thank you so much. That's excellent information.
And that was chipdrop.com, I believe.
Yes, that's what I heard too. So I was like, I'm gonna check that out.
Well, if all fails, just Google it. So I'm sure you'll find it. Yeah. Okay. Next up, we've got Cheryl in Verona. Cheryl, how can we help you?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I want to have another question after my first one.
Okay.
So I right now have in my garden really successful broccoli plants next to really not successful cauliflower. So I'm just trying to figure out why the broccoli is performing well, but the cauliflower is not, which is in the same general area.
You know, I'll tell you, cauliflower is a very challenging vegetable for us. Broccoli can be somewhat, too. They both like cooler temperature during harvest. Broccoli is much more tolerant of heat, usually just doesn't taste as well. So sometimes two things to always watch for. If you're buying transplants and there's already a head on the broccoli or cauliflower, pass by those transplants because they're putting that energy and it causes what's called buttoning and it never fully develops, because it's already sending energy into forming the flower head. You can pinch it off and you'll get some smaller heads throughout the season, but not real effective and not as much productivity as you want. For cauliflower, when we get the high temperatures, and think about our spring. I remember I was speaking somewhere the end of April and it was 22 degrees in the morning when I started my day. And a month later it was 97, right?
Yeah.
And so even if you got your plants out at the proper time this year, if you could beat the rain and the weather, it got hot really fast, and that causes cauliflower to form those curds, and often you'll get leaves in the middle of the head, and the flavor's not as good. It's less tolerant of the heat. With broccoli, when it gets hot, it may not form heads as readily. They may be a little more bitter. I like to just keep harvesting throughout the summer, and then when the temperatures cool, you know, I'm not getting the big heads anymore, but I'm getting the little side sprouts, and the flavor is so much better when the temperatures are cool. So it's nothing you're doing wrong. It's just, I know I feel like a broken record, but on the weather,
yeah.
Cauliflower is very sensitive to heat.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Cheryl. And Melinda, Sarah Hopeful, who's doing on-air production with us today, did say that if you Google Chip Drop, it pops right up, but the actual address is getchipdrop.com. So,
great. Thank
yes,
you, Sarah.
Yes. Okay. Melinda Myers is back with us today to help you with your garden. What questions do you have? Give us a call. We actually have some lines open. 1-800-642-1234. So let's go back to the phones. And Judy is next. And she's on the road in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. One is about tomatoes and tomato blight. We've had blight for several years. We opened a whole new area up, planted tomatoes, and it seems like it's a repeat every year. We break off the blighted areas and dispose of them well away from the garden area, and it just seems like we cannot solve this problem. Any help?
Is it early blight or late blight?
We have it now.
Okay. And your plants, it slowly causes damage versus almost like overnight?
Yeah.
I mean, they spot, okay. Late blight's pretty, you know, it hits and your plants die pretty quickly. Early, and they're both very frustrating. Early blight is a little bit easier to manage. So it sounds like you're doing everything right. Do you stake or tower your tomatoes?
Yes, we do. We tower them.
Do you mulch the soil?
With leaves or things like that, no.
Okay. A couple things you might want to try. So some of these you may be doing, but for others who are struggling, with the diseases like septorial leaf spot, early blight, you're doing good sanitation and cleanup. That's great. Anytime you have disease or insect problems, clean that garden up, get that debris out. Staking your tomatoes or towering them allows better airflow and light penetration, fewer diseases, proper spacing. I find that one of the biggest challenges for me is remembering to give those, not trying to squeak one more tomato in. So proper spacing. The benefit of mulching is it helps hold any of the disease, soil-borne disease organisms in the soil. So spreading shredded leaves or straw, marsh hay, evergreen needles, whatever kind of mulch you have available, grass clippings from a lawn that has not been treated with a weed killer, that's going to help hold those in. You may decide to, full sun, good airflow, those are the kind of places you want. You may choose at first sign of disease to spray because this has been a continual issue for you, even though you're doing everything else correctly. And then there are some organic products, some copper-containing products, and neem, I think, is labeled for that, N-E-E-M as in Mary. But there are some organic as well as more traditional synthetic fungicides. Read and follow label directions. But if you can catch it at the first sign, remove the disease-infected leaves that are showing symptoms, and start your program, that may help you get it under control. And sometimes it's a matter of just breaking the cycle, even though you've moved your tomatoes and you started a new site. I would try those things to see if you can help mulch at this point, remove the disease leaves you find, and consider, and I know it's either you spray or you just deal with what nature gives you, so up to you.
Okay, thank you, Judy. Melinda, what's your thoughts on actually pruning tomato plants? My grandfather always did it, but
my dad did too. My dad staked tomatoes, and he'd be out there every night removing the suckers, and those are the branch, the branches that form between the leaves and the stem. That's critical when you stake tomatoes because there's only so much room, so you only want one or two vines to tie up to the stake. And I have tried for years. I thought, okay, I can do this. So one of the things that I do is I just tower my tomatoes. I've kind of given up staking. And then sometimes they get overrun with branches, and so maybe selectively removing some of those suckers, one, so they fit in the tower, and two, so that there is some airflow and light penetration. But with towering, you don't have to prune as much as you do when you're staking your tomatoes. You know, it's good. It's kind of the level of maintenance and the results you want.
Sure. He put a lot of time into his tomatoes, so that makes total sense.
You hope you get good results.
Exactly. Okay, up next we have Matt in Madison. Matt, what question do you have?
Yes, good morning. Thank you for your program. I have a beautiful rose bush that the first couple of years it produced roses, but the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, it hasn't flowered, but the plant is very healthy and robust, and I just don't know how to get it to flower.
Great question, Matt. We typically always thought of only hybrid tea roses being grafted, where they take, say, the Peace or the Tropicana, a bud from that, and they graft it onto a hardy rootstock so that that plant can really get a good start and then be able to survive our winter. Now, depending on you where you live and who you talk to, typically southerners plant with the graft above ground. Some Midwesterners and northerners plant it at ground level. I'm one of those that plants it deeper for insulation. Now, some of the newer roses that are introduced, for example, Knockout. I talked to Will Radler, who was the breeder who introduced Knockout, and I said, well, yours are on their own rootstock. Well, most of them are, but depending on the nursery who's propagating and growing them, some have grafted them. So if you bought a rose that was grafted, okay, and it would have that knobby growth right above the roots, that if that dies, then the rootstock, the hardy rootstock, takes over, and you may not have flowers, or you may get some different kind of flowers, and typically the growth is a little coarser in texture than the original rose. So I'm guessing if the plant looks healthy, isn't flowering, it's in good full sun, you're not over-fertilizing, there's a chance it was a grafted rose and that graft died over winter, and so you're just getting the rootstock, the hardy rootstock, sending up leaves and no flowers.
So he won't get any flowers no matter how long he waits?
Well, he might get, a lot of times you'll get some, there's a lot of rootstocks that produce red flowers, and often you can get that. If it's a climbing rose, some of them only bloom on older growth, so that's another possibility if it dies back to the ground. If it's one of the climbing roses that blooms on older wood, you may need to provide some winter protection so that you protect that growth so that it's able to produce the flowers. Or if you're pruning it back hard in the spring or the previous fall, then you're eliminating a lot of the growth that would flower as well.
Okay. Well, Matt, thank you for that question, and good luck. I hope you get flowers soon. Let's go to John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm starting a mulch pile, and I did the chicken wire in a square, and I've been putting my leaves and grass clippings and things in there. But somebody at the hardware store said to put kosher salt on it to make it break down. But if it's not kosher salt, then what else would I put on top of it to have it break down? I really don't have garbage like eggshells and that sort of thing to put on it. So what would you suggest?
Well, I have to honestly say with composting or building a mulch pile or compost pile, I've never heard of putting kosher salt on it.
I haven't either. That's a new one.
One of the things to speed up composting is the smaller the pieces. So, you know, if you shred your leaves before you throw them in the compost pile or your grass clippings are already chopped up and ready to go, mixing things that are high in nitrogen, like kitchen scraps, which you said you don't have, but for others, you know, grass clippings, weeds that have not gone to seed, annual weeds. Don't put quack grass, don't put bindweed, because you'll have it in your compost pile.
Yeah.
And mix that with dried material, you know, straw and peat moss and dried fall leaves. That will help speed things up. You want to keep it the moisture of a consistency of a damp sponge that's been wrung out. The good news is, if you do nothing but throw this stuff in a heap, it eventually will form compost. It's the more you do, the faster you get results. The other thing is a lot of places sell compost starters, microorganisms that will help start the compost pile. But really, if you throw your old containers, let's say in fall you dump your basket of petunias in your compost pile, or you put a shovel of your soil in there and mix it in, or some compost that you've already made, that's going to inoculate your pile, and you really don't need to spend that extra money. And then when you make your pile, if it's at least 3 feet by 3 feet, it's going to tend to heat up. The material in the center tends to break down quickly. As that pile cools, you move the stuff from the center out to the side, and the stuff from the side into the center where it tends to be hotter. One of the nice things about those wire cage-type compost bins is you can, if you have the room, just open it up, move it, and then turn your compost pile right next to where it was in the, you know, because you've moved that bin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the good news is compost happens just if we put it in heat, right?
Yes.
No food, no weeds gone to seed, no perennial weeds, nothing diseased or insect-infested. It will happen, and the more effort you put in, the quicker you get results. And then I'm glad you called to ask. I'm going to have to do a little internet surfing to see where this is coming from. But
that seems very unusual to me.
It does. And salt is not the best thing for plants.
No.
I always worry when we get into salting things.
Yes.
You know, we all see what de-icing salt does to our gardens.
Yeah, right. Well, we're talking to Melinda Myers, and she's giving us some help with our gardens. If you've got a question, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. And, of course, you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we do have a couple of lines open, so we'll be happy to take those calls. Next up, we've got Rod in Arlington. Hi, Rod.
How are you doing today? Thank you for taking my call. Two questions. First of all, watering a garden when we have weather like this, I've been doing it in the early morning before the sun gets too high, hoping that it'll hold some of the extra moisture in. Second of all, would it be worth the time? I built my wife a small raised garden because she has some mobility issues. And would it be worth the time to build a pergola type device where I could shade the garden when we have excessively dry and hot sunny days and be able to open it up and allow more moisture to get through and just use like nylon screening or something to use as a shading item on our garden? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks, Rod.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's a very interesting concept. That's a very common practice in the South where, you know, when plants that we grow in full sun and they do great, when you look at descriptions and they talk if your summers are hot, well, that would be in the south typically, though this year it's Wisconsin, they'll often do exactly what you're saying. So one of the things that you'll want to do is plants that tend to be sensitive to really high temperatures may be worth the effort to do that. Mulching the soil, keeping the roots cool and moist is really a good place to start for those people that may not be as handy as you sound, Rod. And, you know, a movable shade cloth that you could, you know, put it out when it's extreme is definitely going to reduce the stress on your plants and also hold the moisture longer. Actually, a few years ago, I received a sample, I think it was a company out of the UK, that was a little umbrella that you could put over your container garden.
Oh.
I know. And so it was either for your succulents that were getting too much water or for your plants that needed a little bit of shade from the heat. And
I love that. That sounds so English. I
do. It does, doesn't it?
Well, and, you know, so, as our temperatures change, I mean, we seem to be getting warmer and warmer. These are really things we need to think about, aren't they?
Oh, you bet. You know, even our planting and our varieties, you know, we always looked for short season tomatoes that could take cooler summers. Now we're thinking, you know, maybe we need to pay more attention to some of those heat-loving varieties and planting strategies and times. You know, we talked about cauliflower and broccoli, and spring's a really crazy busy for me telling everyone else what to do.
Sure.
I don't get my garden in. And so a lot of times I plant my broccoli in all my other cool crops around the middle, early to middle of July for a fall harvest. So I don't get the early season harvest. I have to go to the farmer's market, which is fine, support agriculture.
Sure.
But I'll get it in the fall, and those crops can take a light frost, and the flavor gets better. So we also need to think about adjusting when we plant to take advantage of the weather that the vegetables and flowers prefer.
Okay. Well, let's take another call here. We've got Robin in Portage. Hi, Robin.
Good. Well, I think it's still morning. I'm not sure.
It sure is for 15 more minutes.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call, Melinda. I have not spoken with you before, and I have called in about this problem in the past. I have a patch of wild blackberries, and they did beautifully up until the last 3 years. This year is a disaster. Each year they have gotten rust. And each year I'm cutting out the rust and cutting more. Well, this year I don't have hardly any plants left. Even the young ones that I've caught up around the older ones that have rust, they're coming back with rust. Am I going to have to destroy this whole patch, or what can I do?
Have you talked to the fruit experts from UW Extension when they were on as well? Because I feel like that's, or Brian Huddleston from the Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab. Those are.
No, I'm not really sure who I've spoken to before.
Okay. I mean, you're doing everything you can. You may want to, in the spring, which you're probably doing, but just for anyone else with rust, in spring, just make sure that you get rid of those infected plants as early as possible and dig them up in roots and all and get them out of there. So, yes, it sounds like if all your plants are coming back infected, I'm afraid you're going to have to start over. There are some fungicides, sulfur-type fungicides, that will help prevent. They won't cure what's infected. They're not internal, but they will help, you know, prevent the infection, so getting that spray down early. You may want to clean up the old patch before you plant new blackberries, just making sure that you're not, you know, you don't have those spores around. You know, get the diseased plants out of the area, because you'd hate to plant new plantings and those spores infect your new planting and you're starting all over. So it sounds like you're doing everything. Early spring sanitation, look for resistant varieties if at all possible. If you can find those, that's probably about all you can do. So it sounds like you're doing everything, and I think the disease might be winning.
Oh, I know it's sad when you hear that.
It is. Yeah. It is. All that effort you put in, Robin, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but the UW Extension Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, I think it's worth dropping an email if you go online and type in UWEX Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. you can email and see if they may have some other recommendations before you give it up.
Okay. You're listening to Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network, and we're talking to Melinda Myers. She's a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, and author and columnist. And we're taking your gardening questions. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Welcome back to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today, and Melinda Myers is with us. Melinda, before we get back to the phones, I believe you are going to be at State Fair once again.
You bet. It's always a fun opportunity. We Energies hires me to speak every day, twice a day, and thanks to a lot of people who donate product and plants and the Wisconsin Landscape Contractors Association, Milwaukee Metro chapter, we get to create this beautiful garden, so it's like the best classroom ever. So this year our theme is green and easy, and people can come see me at 10 or 2 and bring their questions, and I'll talk about just some low-maintenance strategies, winning plants, some of the new All-America Selection winners donated by Berner Botanical Gardens, some pollinator plants, some indoor plants. I have some cool products, a hydroponic setup to help grow, herbs, just a tabletop thing, herbs and houseplants indoors, and with low maintenance, and dual bin composters, and a storm garden, which is a combination of a rain barrel rain garden that's very attractive and beautiful, a new product that will be on display and we'll talk about. So it's always fun because I get to, like we were talking about, meet all your listeners and other gardeners, answer questions, show some new and fun different things, and it's the fair.
Yay, it's the fair. And that's at, you're at the We Energies Energy Park stage, right?
Correct. Okay. Yes. Okay. So you'll find me, it's located along 84th Street, obviously, inside the fairgrounds at Whitley Way. And
okay.
You can't miss us. We're usually near one of the new, by the tropical drink and music booth, so there's entertainment across the way if you get bored with me.
Well, and if people want to find out more about where you're going to be appearing, what's your website?
MelindaMyers.com, and we have audio and video tips and a list of appearances, and sign up for our e-newsletter, and you can win a chance, have a chance to win a $500 gift certificate from Gardener Supply.
Oh, so, nice.
I know, and if you need help deciding what to purchase, I can advise.
Well, and I've been to your website. It is nice, and there's a lot of information out there, so people should check that out.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones, and we've got Amber Lee in Stevens Point with a question. Amber?
Yeah, I'm here.
What's your question?
Hi, I'm just wondering if you have any natural ways of keeping rabbits from eating everything in the garden when you don't have the proper fencing?
You know, I'm going to share my pathetic story. So I have a 7-foot-high fence around my garden, and the gates, I know, have not been secure, but it's kind of out away from the house, and there's open grass, and rabbits have not been a problem until this year. So now I have a rabbit inside my fence garden. We secured the gate, so Amberlee, I can totally relate here. So I waited to plant, and now I just feel like, well, I left plants in the garden. I thought, well, eat them before I plant them, okay? And I put a trap out, and the ground squirrels are eating all of the carrots and the apples, and they're not heavy enough to set off the trap, and the rabbit's eating everything outside. So you're thinking, I'm the wrong person to ask, but I can give you advice.
You sound like a Beatrix Potter novel is what you sound like. Yeah.
It does. And they're so cute. You know?
They are.
So I'm a couple things. You can try repellents. The problem is once they start eating, it's hard to keep them out. I've been using some bird netting around plants that I know are their favorites, at least until they get established. The key, though, is you need to elevate it, because I did, and I just covered my cabbage and my artichokes, and they love artichokes. And they were able to nibble through the little holes in the bird netting, and they pulled the, yes.
My.
I know. That's exactly how I sounded, Jill, when I found them. And so I replanted. They got the new batch. So I've elevated it. So I've made it more like a covering, you know, so it's above the plants, at least until they get established. So it does seem like a pain that you've got fencing and you're netting and using repellents. Live trapping, the problem is nobody really wants your rabbits. I live out in the country now, so I can at least get them, if I can trap it into the woods, hopefully away. You always want to make sure you're not separating a mom from the babies, because if you want to be humane, you know, that would be inhumane. So you could try repellents, just realizing they've already found some good eats in your garden. You can try scare tactics, but if you're in the city, they're so used to you and people and the smell, they're not always effective. And then maybe just temporarily covering or netting your plants, at least to protect them until they get established and can tolerate some of the damage.
Okay, well, good luck, Amber Lee. Yeah, and there are a lot of rabbits this year. At least I know they are down here. So,
Everywhere I go, I have never seen so many. We have a lot of fox and hawks and all kinds of predators here, but I guess they can't even keep up with the population this year.
Yeah, I noticed that too. Let's see. Our next caller is Rod in Weyerhaeuser. Hi, Rod. Rod, are you with us? Rod?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. What question do you have for us?
I have three questions, but I was just going to, I try to be helpful too. I was going to make two comments. You know the lady I called before about the blackberries?
Right. Yes.
I don't know now if those are domestic blackberries, if it holds true, but I know my dad is 96. He said when they were kids, I live up in Russ County here where it's all a glacial hill where these hills, rocks and stuff, you know, when you got these steep hills. They're not big, but they're steep, and then they're going up and down, you know, if you've ever been up in the Blue Hills area. But anyhow, he said in the 30s, there was several dry years, and the fires would go off because they would hire people to sit up all night. In fact, his uncle was a bachelor. They would hire him. But the fires, you know, and he said after them fires went through, he said the blackberries, the big old long blackberries, and he said them vines you could stick in there one place is still like a lard bucket or an ice cream bucket in one place. So I don't know if fire, like she had problems with fungus.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and you mentioned when you talk about, when you read publications, they talk about destroy and burning diseased materials one way, but a lot of us don't have that option to burn the debris. So you're right. Your grandfather made a great observation. It destroyed a lot of the fungal and the disease plant material. So it was a way of sanitizing the garden. Thank you for sharing that. You had some other comments?
Well, yeah. Okay. I also plant got asparagus and I got blueberries and rhubarb. And but I was wondering. Okay, the rhubarb. I'll start with the rhubarb. Is it good if you cut the biggest ones right as close to the ground as you can, and then it'll propagate better?
You mean cut the leaves when you're harvesting, cut the big ones at the base, and then let new growth, is that what you're saying, so that you have more growth coming?
Right, that's what I've heard, you know, and I just wondered if it'll propagate.
Right, so I wasn't sure when you said propagating if you were digging and dividing or what, but yeah, when you're harvesting, if you do regular harvesting, that promotes new growth. We usually harvest for 8 to 10 weeks with rhubarb. It's safe to eat always the stems, but the flavor isn't as good as the temperatures get hotter. And also you want to let that plant put more energy back in. So those leaves are important in forming energy to go back into the root system. So, you know, typically when we harvest from the outside in, and then we let the plants after 8 to 10 weeks, then we just let them go and grow so that they can really put energy back for next year's harvest.
Okay, and Rod, I think you had one more question, maybe the asparagus?
The asparagus. Yeah, when I put more in, one lady, she's part of horticulture, said it'll spread even on sod, but I was wondering, wouldn't it help if I killed, like, and stayed 5-6 feet away from it and just killed it or quack dug it so that it would spread faster? Would that help it?
Oh, so tilling the soil so that it spreads more quickly, your asparagus plant spread more quickly, is that what? I'm just having some trouble with it.
I think that's what his question was.
Okay. Well, you know, anytime we can dig and amend the soil, so if you have sandy soil, adding organic matter helps hold moisture. Asparagus is pretty drought tolerant, and clay soil improves drainage. So amending a larger area than just that little narrow trench that we typically dig is definitely going to be good for your plants. The soil will be better. You'll have disrupted it. If you have quack grass and you till it, you're propagating the quack grass. We want to be careful that you know, cultivation will handle quackgrass if you do it twice a month for 2 years. But if you only cultivate once and then plant, you've just propagated the quackgrass. So you just want to be careful about tilling up an area infested with quackgrass. Just know that you're going to get more of it than once it recovers and comes back.
Very touchy with that quackgrass.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we've just got about a minute left here, Melinda. And we did have Chris from Platteville ask if, with the wood chip discussion, is there a chance of spreading disease from trees?
You know, most problems are handled once they're chopped up and shredded. There is a concern with verticillium wilt, and I feel like I'm getting Dr. Brian Huddleston at the extensions.
He won't mind.
Brian's a good guy.
Yeah.
So one of the things most tree care companies and municipalities tend to be very careful about, not spreading disease. The other concern is black walnut. Black walnuts are toxic to many plants, all parts of them. So if you mulch a sensitive plant like tomatoes with black walnut wood chips, that juglone in those wood chips can affect the tomato, stunt them, and even kill them. So you always want to ask where the tree's coming from. You know, how do they manage it, and making sure that it isn't an issue that's going to spread, whether it's black walnut toxicity or a disease problem.
Absolutely. Thank you. We've been talking with Melinda Myers. She's nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, and author and columnist. You can catch up with Melinda by going to her website, melindamyers.com. Well, stay with us. There's always more to come on the Ideas Network. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today. Our guest is Melinda Myers. She's a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author and columnist with over 30 years of horticulture experience, and she has written over 20 gardening books. What gardening questions do you have? Give us a call. Our lines are all open, 1-800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Melinda, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
We had a couple of callers that emailed to tell us what they use to keep out rabbits, so maybe we could try this. Nancy called to suggest sprinkling crushed red pepper on your plants to deter rabbits, and it works for her. Have you heard about that one?
Yes. In fact, there's even a repellent that it's a hot pepper wax that they use, and they put a little wax to help it stick.
Ah.
And that's one of those things with any repellent, whether it's a homemade or commercial, always monitor, just like your fence. Make sure it's working. Sometimes they get used to it, or if there are enough of them, they're hungry. But I have had people have good luck with that, sometimes even with squirrels as well as rabbits.
Ah, okay. And Lorene emailed. She said that she plants marigolds all around her garden. Out of lack of funds, she repotted her yard full of marigolds, and the rabbit population totally disappeared.
Well, we'll see if the one in my fenced-in area likes my marigolds I planted. I did some work at Summerfest and worked with kids that were school groups plant the different gardens, and they had put in these marigolds, and the next day all the tops had been eaten by the rabbits.
Oh.
So it's a beautiful way to edge your garden. So if it's working, these are things that I always say, give it a try and monitor. You know, whether you use commercial or homemade or ideas like this. Somebody told me those marigolds weren't big and smelly enough, and that's why the rabbits ate them. So, but no, thank you for sharing. I think, you know, just it's worth a try. It's pretty,
mm-hmm.
You know, but I have seen those and woodchucks. I used to bait live traps when I was at Extension. We had a woodchuck, and I used marigolds. It was their favorite food.
Oh, really? I wouldn't have guessed that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
At least that woodchuck.
At least that particular one. They all have their own taste, right? Okay, well, let's go back to the phones then. We have Norman in Wausau. Norman, are you with us?
Yes.
What's your question?
My question is, I have a beautiful black ice plum that has loaded with plums again this year. It's only 3 years old. Last year it had a lot of plums on, probably 40 or 50 at least, and almost every one split open just before they started to turn ripe.
Oh.
It resulted in the...
Yeah,
yeah, A couple things. What happens when moisture influences not only temperature but moisture? So if we get a lot of moisture when fruit is forming, starting to form, they tend to form more cells, get bigger, and then if it gets dry, those cells tend to shrivel and will get, you know, less than plump fruit. If it's the reverse, it's dry, when the fruit are starting to form and we get a lot of rain towards the end of the season, that can cause the fruit to split open. So it might be monitoring the soil moisture, which is nothing you can do other than making sure the plants receive good, consistent moisture throughout the growing season. If everything else looked fine, most diseases, you would see some spotting, you'd see some, coddling moth causes lumpiness and you'll see the worm inside. So it sounds more like it's a response to the weather we had last year, because a lot of us had dry followed by a lot of rain towards the end, a lot of rain throughout. So, you know, it was variable throughout the state. So monitoring the rainfall and making sure your plants, you know, good thorough watering during extended dry periods just really help keeping that moisture consistent.
Now, Melinda, if he picked those plums before they were completely ripe, and before they split, would they ripen?
Plums don't ripen as well off the plant as some fruit do. When you get animal problems, too, the other thing
yes.
is trying to beat the animals to the harvest. I'm just worried that you wouldn't get that ripening that mm-hmm. you wanted. And so you could still use those plums. You'd need to process them right away,
sure.
whether you make jam or jelly or eat a lot of plums.
Yes. Which isn't a hardship for most of us.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Especially when they're homegrown, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, Norman, thank you and good luck. We hope that those plums don't split on you this
right.
year.
Exactly.
Let's go to Marilyn in Superior. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. We have a vegetable garden that I planted earlier, and then we were gone for a while. And so when I came back, the whole garden is full of purslane.
Oh.
And next week when it's supposed to be cooler up here in the 70s rather than the 80s. But so I intend to get out there and weed the whole thing. And that's not a problem. But I want some ideas of things that I can put on top to avoid the weeds.
Yeah, purslane, when we have really hot weather, especially when it's hot and dry, the purslane does great. And one of the problems is it's an annual, but when it flowers and sets seed, you don't even notice the flowers. And so we often don't get it out of the garden before it drops seeds for next year's crop. There was an interesting article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about making purslane pesto. Purslane has long been eaten, especially by people of Latin descent. Hispanics often steam it and add a little butter and use it as a spinach substitute. Hmm. I haven't tried the pesto recipe. I've tried it. It's okay. You know, I think it's one of those things you're used to pulling it out, so it's hard to think about eating it.
Sure.
So you're right, Marilyn, to get out there and get it out as soon as you can and are able. And then putting shredded leaves, evergreen needles, grass clippings that haven't been treated with a weed killer, any kind of thing that blocks the sun to help suppress the weeds. I have an area in my garden where I mulched it heavy with leaves, and I pulled out my dead tomatoes, but I left the leaf mulch in place. And this spring, there were very few weeds, and the soil is so much better and held the moisture. And so even if you're mulching and leave that mulch on, but take out the dead, any diseased or insect-infested stuff for sure, but that's going to help suppress those weeds when they're popping up in spring.
Okay. Well, thanks, Marilyn. And if anyone's tried that purslane pesto, let us know.
Exactly.
Let us know. Okay, next up, we've got Chris in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hi. My question is this. I have a place up in Marquette County, and I had a proliferation of foxglove. Every year they came back, you know, like clockwork in June. This year, nothing. What happened to them?
Yeah, a couple things might have happened. Foxgloves are biennials, typically in our area. So that means the first year they form leaves. The second year, those plants grow and flower. Our open and cold winter, you know, the cold temperatures this winter might have knocked out any of those plants that were overwintering as that small rosette of leaves, and that might have killed them. You might have you looked around to see if there are any leaves of foxglove?
Yes, I have, and I have not seen any.
Mm. Okay, so you know what you know understand that whole life cycle. I just think it was the cold winter, and the seeds can last for quite a few years in the soil. So if you can leave that area undisturbed, or it's an area, it sounds like it's an area you don't disturb. There may be a chance that some of those seeds are still laying dormant and might sprout for you next year. But I really think it was our winter was really hard on a lot of plants. Some things didn't make it. Some things had a lot of dieback, and others just it took forever for them to sprout and start to grow.
Okay, well, Chris, I feel your pain because
it's one of those. It's wait and see. I'm afraid.
And they're such beautiful flowers too.
Oh, they are.
Yeah.
They are. And sometimes they run their course too. I've had in a few areas where I'll have them for a few years and they just seem to fizzle out.
Yeah.
So it's time to replenish.
Okay. Well, next we have Marianne in Waukesha. Marianne?
Hello.
Hi.
We bought a cherry tree last year, and it's doing very, very well this year. And the leaves are huge, and there are some little yellow oval-shaped lumps at the base of each leaf. And most of them have two lumps, and some of them have three or four lumps. And there are a lot of ants giving them a lot of attention. So I was thinking ants use aphids as to get their food from them, you know, except they're hard lumps firmly attached to the stem, so they can't be aphids. So do you have any ideas?
Yeah, it sounds like if you take your, you might want to try taking your thumbnail and see if you could scratch it off. It sounds like scale almost. So scale, which are insects that form either a soft or hard shell over top of them, suck plant juices like aphids and mites do, secrete the excess, and that clear sticky substance, honeydew, is attractive to ants, just like you've noticed with aphids. It also happens with scale. Typically with trees, we see scale also on the trunk as well as sometimes on the leaves and on the petioles, the leaf stem like you're seeing. What I would recommend is just check the stem, the trunk, to see and make sure that you're not finding those lumps on the trunk as well. If you are, you may want to do some treatment, like a dormant oil spray in the winter when the temperatures are above 40 degrees, or an all-season spray oil will also work, and they cover and basically kind of prevent air exchange and they suffocate, we'll kind of use that term, those insects, and can take care of those. And those are just limited by temperature extremes, but you can do it when the plants are growing. So it sounds like you might have scale from what you're describing. Just see if you can scrape that off with your thumb. And if you can, that's probably a scale insect and doing exactly what you thought. Sucking plant juices and secreting the clear, sticky stuff that the ants love to eat.
And that's always fun to have scale on your plants. But good luck, Marianne. Next, we have John in Appleton calling. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, John.
My call is regarding I'm growing some Wisconsin 55 tomatoes in a community garden. I've got black plastic down to prevent weeds and help maintain moisture, but my tomatoes, I got them in probably a month, easily a month, month and a half ago, but the tomatoes themselves have, the leaves have drooped down around the plants. They're about 18 inches tall, and the leaves are healthy. I mean, they're firm, but the leaves have just drooped down around. It looks just like a clump of a tomato plant. I'm at a loss for what's going on.
One of the things you may want to do is kind of if you can peel back the edge of the plastic and see what's going on. One of the problems with black plastic is it will hold the moisture in, but it doesn't let moisture in. And so, you know, that could be a problem. And also it tends to make the soil warm. And so with all of the heat we've had and then you warm it up even more with that black plastic, it could be heat stress. So you could have a lack of water just because the water's not getting through. Plastic was very popular when I used to manage the community gardens for the Extension Service down here years ago, and they'd come up with the perforated plastic, but it didn't seem to let the water through. Then people would cut holes in the plastic so the weeds would come through, and it's hard on your soil because you're not getting the oxygen exchange. I'm not a huge fan of landscape fabric or weed barriers, but that at least lets air and water through but blocks the sunlight and does help hold the moisture. And some people would pull it up every year and go to the laundromat. I was dismayed because I was going to the laundromat at the time to wash it every year, but take it off and amend the soil. So I'm thinking your black plastic may actually be causing some problems. So peel it back and see what's going on underneath there. How hot does the soil feel? You know, is it really dry? Is it staying too wet? My guess is it might just be too hot, and it may not be getting the moisture the plants need.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not a fan of that black plastic either. That stuff was horrid.
And then cleaning up at the end of the season was always a bad day.
Oh, it was terrible. Okay, next up we've got Jill in Racine. Hi, Jill.
Hi. First, I have a comment about marigolds. I bought some, and then I started some from seed, and the ones grown by seed are beautiful. They grow in a clump, and it's beautiful. But my question is, I have three butternut squash. Two are full sun, and then one is not full sun. One of them in full sun looks perfectly healthy and growing. The other one has yellow leaves. What causes that?
Does it look wilted, or are they just kind of discolored and yellow, not as green as they should be?
Discolored and yellow.
A couple things I'd look for. One, at the base of the plants, there's an insect called a squash vine borer, and it burrows in. The adult's a black and red day-flying moth, and it lays its eggs at the base of squash plants. When the eggs hatch, the little larva eats its way into the stem and starts feeding up the stem. Often what we see is the plant suddenly wilted. We look at the base of the stem, and we see this sawdust-like frass, and those are the droppings, and it's blocked, you know, it's destroyed the system that takes water and nutrients between the leaves and the roots. So you might want to see if that's an early sign. You might want to check soil moisture, even though the plants are both in full sun. Is the soil around one wetter or drier than the other? Is drainage different? Because yellow leaves can be too much or not enough water as well. Powdery mildew, we can see some yellow, but it's more spots, and then the white powdery-like substance forms on the leaf, and we're seeing a fair amount of powdery mildew this year, and squash plants tend to develop that. Even though you've got it in full sun, perfect. Good airflow and proper spacing are some of the ways to reduce the problems with powdery mildew. Some people choose to treat using an organic or synthetic fungicide just because severe infestations can cause a lot of leaf drop and reduce your harvest. Sometimes, though, we have plenty, so we don't care if we lose a few. So I would check soil moisture, check the base of that plant with the yellow leaves to see if there's any squash vine borer in, you know, doing damage. If you do find that frass, slice the stem, leave the roots attached, and then kill the borer when you find it. Then bury that portion of the stem. And often it's already started to root along the stem. If not, keep that soil slightly moist, and the plant often roots, and you may have fewer squash, but you'll save the plant. And I've had pretty good success salvaging plants that were infected with squash vine borer doing that.
Okay, great. Well, I hope that works for you, Jill, because, you know, we usually tend to have too many squash, don't we?
Well, yeah, it always seemed like, oh, one more plant.
Oh, sure, one more won't hurt.
That's
okay.
Right.
Joe in Viroqua, you're next.
Yes, good afternoon. By previous standards, the past winters we've been having have been very wimpy compared to years ago. All of this winter long, every month I had leaves blowing around in my yard. And the reason was lack of snow cover. Snow cover is a wonderful insulation.
You bet.
I'm sure that's the cause of a lot of dead bulbs and whatever plants didn't come back.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
Oh, exactly. And it was cold, below zero, and open. And you're absolutely right. Snow is the best insulator. the best mulch we can have.
Absolutely. Not that we want too much of it, but no. You know, just enough, right? Just enough.
Right.
Okay, let's
and
go.
And then it stays.
And then it stays. Yes, exactly. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, would be.
Kim in River Falls, you're next. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have Phalaenopsis orchids on my windowsill, and they drip something sticky all over. And is there anything I can do to stop this? It comes off the leaves or something.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got an insect, and some of the things that'll do that, aphids that suck plant juices secrete the excess, and they'll leave that clear, sticky substance, spider mites, scale. Sometimes you'll see scale on orchids there. You'll see maybe a brown kind of lump on a leaf, on the leaves, and if you can scrape it off with a toothbrush or your thumbnail, you'll remove the adult, but the immature, somewhat translucent, looking for a good place to feed. And so the problem with scale is it's a tough one to control. You have to really be persistent to take care of it. For aphids and mites, check the label. I don't always trust my memory, so you always want to check the label to make sure orchids are labeled for use with either a lightweight horticulture oil or insecticidal soap if you're looking for an organic control, or an insecticide label for that use. But always check the label, and if in doubt, test it on a leaf. But it sounds like one of these insects, even a strong blast of water, you know, putting it in the sink and hosing off the leaves, if it's aphids and mites and doing that on a weekly basis, often will reduce the population. And if you get rid of the insect, you'll get rid of that clear, sticky substance.
Okay, and I have done that myself with orchids with the water, and it does seem to help. So hopefully,
oh, good.
Yeah, so hopefully that'll work for Kim. Next, we have Arlene in Burlington. Hi, Arlene. Arlene, are you there?
I'm here, yes.
Okay, what's your question?
I have a trumpet vine and several different climbing vines that I bring in large pots. And this year when I didn't cut them back. And now when they're growing outside, they have about a 2-foot bare stem on them before they start flowering. Should I be cutting them back down in the wintertime in the house?
Okay.
Yeah, and so one of the benefits of pruning, whether it's outside or inside, some of the vigorous vines is doing exactly what you want to accomplish, which is getting new leaf growth lower on the plant, getting it fuller so you have flowers at a shorter variety. Typically with plants we bring indoors, we want to do our pruning in February, March, and I'm assuming, are you leaving them dormant and then bringing them out as dormant plants, or are you growing them like plants in a window, or sort of a little bit in between?
Kind of in between. I lost one that didn't come back, and then this one eventually went dormant, and I thought it was dead, took it outside, watered it, and it came back to life. So I
okay, and Melinda, we've got like a minute left.
Okay, so what I would recommend you do is there are a couple things. So if you're keeping it like a houseplant and growing, you may want to do your pruning, say, February, March, so that it stimulates growth but doesn't interfere with flowering. If you're letting it go dormant or it looks dormant, you bring it out, then you can do your pruning, start your watering, and watch it come back and put out leaves at the base. And that'll help get flowers and leaves over most of the plant.
Okay, well, great. Thank you. Melinda, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a delight to have you with us.
Thank you, Jill. It's always fun, and I love talking to all your listeners and hearing their advice as well.
Good. Well, we'll look for you at the State Fair. Melinda Myers is a nationally known garden expert. Thank you so much for being with us. And thanks to Dave Potras for technical direction and Sarah Hopeful for on-air production. Hope you can join us on Monday. Our physical therapy experts will be here to talk about the effects of concussion, and they'll also take your physical therapy questions. That starts at 11. I'm Jill Nadeau.